welcome to Blackwood, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us for our second lunchtime talk in celebration of Academic Book Week. We are delighted to be joined by Professor Danny Dorling, who will be discussing today Reducing Inequality, Reasons for Hope in 2007, which of course we all have lots of hope for 2007. Danny Dorling is the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the School of Geography and Environment here at the University of Oxford. He specialises in issues of housing, health, employment, education and poverty, and has written an array of best-selling books around these topics, including Injustice, All That Is Solid, Inequality in the 1%, and A Better Politics, which is just on display on this table over there. So I hope you enjoy the talk, and please can I ask you to join me in giving a very warm welcome to Professor Danny Dorling. Thank you.
Thank you ever so much for coming, particularly given the most ridiculous title for a talk for the start of 2017. I did suggest a title a few months ago, I think before Donald was elected, but I still think it's a fairly good thing to talk about. What I'm going to say to you for about 30 minutes and then we do questions is a slightly odd way of looking at things. The reason I think we should be optimistic is because things are so bad and so many people now realise they are so bad, and we didn't realise they were quite so bad, particularly for people who were very well off until quite recently. You easily discount how quickly you learn. But if we go back 5, 10, 15 years, an enormous amount of what we now know, we didn't know. So I've got some notes here, so this will be a bit stilted, because I'm just going to use evidence that's come to light in 2016 and in the first 2 weeks of 2017 to say how much worse things have got, and then suggest to you that if this isn't what it takes to get change, it's quite hard to imagine what would get change. Now, I do know this is an odd way of arguing. When I was starting my PhD in the late 1980s, I was very taken with a quote from a physicist called Rudy Rucker, who wrote that it might feel like time is changing, but that's just the feeling you get from being a certain kind of space-time being, and it isn't really. And although it might be very profound, it isn't particularly helpful if you are that kind of space-time being for whom time is changing. Similarly, if you do happen to be middle class, largely, stuck in the United Kingdom at a point at which it is doing particularly stupid things and stupid things are happening to it, and when your Prime Minister has just got on a plane to go and creep to a particularly, maybe the worst ever, we haven't given him long yet. You never know. Maybe the worst ever president of the United States. It can feel particularly bad. But part of my argument is it would be much worse if there was more widespread acquiescence to this. It would be worse if the BBC, which is hardly a radical organisation, wasn't actually looking at this in horror. If you look at some of their reports, they're finding it very hard to keep the expression on their faces that they're supposed to keep. What we get out of this is not certain, but let me just go through some things that we know now that we didn't know just a year ago. Angus Deaton, who got the Nobel Prize recently, wrote late last year that we've just discovered that life expectancy from 40 years of age onwards in the United States for the top 1% in the US is slightly higher than in any other country for the best off 1% in any other country. Only slightly higher. And we didn't know that until recently. But it's not much higher than for people in Sweden and the Netherlands. In contrast, life expectancy from age 40 for the bottom 1% in the States is around the average for Sudan and Pakistan, and the bottom 10% are not far off that. So what we've learned, and we didn't know things were very tough at the bottom of the US, we didn't know how little people at the top of the US were actually getting for their money. The US spends 16% of its GDP on health, more than any other rich country. This is an enormous sum of money. That money is concentrated on the very richest Americans. And it shows that you can prolong life by a few weeks if the private healthcare insurers try hard enough to wire you up and keep you going. But it's just a few weeks, that's all they're getting. This is one of my first reasons for optimism. If they were getting a year, what if they were getting 5 years? What if they were just getting 2 years of relatively better, healthy life rather than, you know, being wired up life? You could kind of be pessimistic. You could say, well, this is all fairly awful, but it makes sense for a group at the top of the United States to behave like this because they really are having a better time than anybody else from behaving like it. When you saw Donald and his wife dancing, didn't they look happy? The answer is no, they didn't. And it would be far worse if they did. It would be actually bad if you thought that their children are going to leave happy lives, if you didn't look at that family and think, actually, I'm so glad that's not my family. You think where you wouldn't want to be. Let's look at the most unequal large place in the world. And again, things we've only just learned. The most unequal large place in the world is Brazil. Brazil has by far the worst record on income inequality. So bad it's actually been very hard to get statistics on Brazil because in Brazil the government can't be bothered to collect or produce statistics. We've only known very roughly. But this year, a PhD student in Brazil has finally worked out the detailed stats, and if you want to know how bad it can get, the best off tenth of people in Brazil have 53% of all income, but they don't feel particularly well off because half of that's taken by the best off 1%. They don't feel particularly well off because 44% of that is taken by the best off 0.1%. So if you're in the best off 1% in Brazil, you're getting about 50 times average earnings. But the people just above you, people you'll know, because there aren't that many people in the top 1%, are getting 500 times average earnings. And when you look at the cost of private education in Brazil, the cost of security, the cost for getting the house a little bit further away from the favela in a slightly nicer gated estate, the cost of the chauffeurs and the servants you'll need, you're going to feel poor if you're in the bottom of the 1% in Brazil. People in the bottom of the 1% in Britain actually feel poor. But in Brazil it is more obvious. October 2016, Forbes magazine celebrated the failure of the Brazilian Workers' Party to control the local elections. But it noted that no other politicians were popular in Brazil either. Brazil is the worst case, I think, in South America. South America includes the best cases of countries that have reduced inequalities in the last 10 to 15 years. About half of the richest countries in the world have seen reductions in inequality recently. None of that is reported. Nobody reports when right-wing votes fall in Europe. Right-wing votes have fallen in as many countries as they have risen in the last 10 to 15 years. But it's a news story when they rise, it's a news story when somebody almost becomes president of Austria, but doesn't. It isn't a news story when you actually see the falls, and you won't be able to name me the large European countries that have not a single far-right party. Right? There are at least two, but it's not reported. The good news doesn't get reported. Forbes magazine is interested in Brazil from the point of view of investors. And Brazil is interesting for investors because it is an oil economy. But not all countries which have oil end up getting mucked up by investors. Again, 2016, in May, Miles Corak updated his social mobility estimates. And his social mobility estimates showed that social mobility is particularly high in Canada. Canada is a very good news story for things going on worldwide, but even better in Norway. These are both oil or tar sand economies. Because we are in the UK, and it is only the UK and the USA, and to a small extent Israel, in the rich world, that has got much worse when it comes to inequality in the last 5 years. We tend to think that this is happening everywhere. We also have an overblown sense of our own importance. With some colleagues, I've recently been finishing the second edition of a European Atlas about what countries are in Europe, on the edge of the European Union, how they're changing, how they're joining. And we've just got to the point of correcting the proofs of the Atlas, and we thought we ought to put something in about Brexit. But the Atlas is about all of Europe, including countries like Turkey. And in fact, the UK is a small part of the Atlas, so we ended up just putting a line in saying the United Kingdom may be leaving the European Union. That's the only change we actually felt it was worth putting. People know. Next to the list of the places and the millions of population who are currently signed up to join, which of course we don't talk about. If you're here now, and particularly in Oxford, because this city potentially is more affected by Brexit than any other, we talk about all those places who voted for Brexit, who have European structural funds or did going to them, but we get far more European structural funds. We just don't call them structural funds. We call them science funding, and we have the highest science funding of anywhere in Europe. Or we call it a BMW car plant, which is only here because of the word Oxford, and where the advantage of Oxford dramatically reduces if we do a hard Brexit. They may still produce some minis for internal market, but you wouldn't produce any to export if there was a trade. Yes. Let me get back to this. When you look at Miles Corak's graph, you find that social mobility is particularly bad in Brazil and Peru and China, but that's largely because it matters if you grew up in rural or urban China. And then Chile. And then
this
the United.
This is a customer announcement. Well, Blackwells are conducting a free historic internal tour of our 138-year-old history.
Ooh.
Where you will see Sir Basil Blackwell's beautiful Edwardian-style office, where he met up with such authors as A.A. Milne, Graham Greene, Sir John Betjeman, and also where Dorothea L. Sayers was once his personal assistant.
Was she?
The next tour is from the ground floor at 12:45. Thank you.
12:45. Right, I better speed up. Okay. Okay. So our social mobility is awful, but it generally is bad in unequal countries because you try really hard to look after your kids if you're rich in an unequal country. We learned yesterday, though, that even if you make it, if you're working class and you get a middle class job, on average you'll be paid £6,800 less, 17% less, through various mechanisms. You can see exactly how it works. I'm a middle class son of a middle class family, so my salary is higher, because I know what to do when I'm offered a job at the University of Oxford. Right? So we have very low social mobility. But isn't that okay for the children of the rich because they're safe? Well, no, because when you look at these graphs, the correlations are that you're 0.6, 0.7 times, the correlation is 0.6, 0.7 to be like your parents. That still leaves you with a big chance of not being like your parents. And the fall is a very long way down. So although I'm a middle class child who's got a secure job at the University of Oxford, the chances of my children having that, I have three children, one of them are odds on to get a secure job. And that's with all the corruption, knowledge, insight, nastiness and selfishness that I know I'm capable of. Right, that's one. They would be better off in a more equal country with higher social mobility, because even when they went down wouldn't feel like down would feel like doing something socially useful, something you enjoyed doing, and you'd be able to live with it, and up wouldn't feel so up. The differences are huge. If you look between Brazil and Norway, in Norway 64% of people say they can trust others, in Brazil it's 5%. This is your life, this is your everyday life, is that different? And there are huge differences in what countries think are normal. We have, apparently, 586,000 accountants in Britain. A child of mine who becomes an accountant will be the safe child, possibly. That's more than all the other accountants in Europe combined. And accountants are not particularly productive. I don't want to upset any accountants. There's a question about how many actually need. France and Germany apparently have 34,000 apiece. Well, look at lawyers. We have a lot of lawyers in the US. They do even better. In 1980, they had 450,000 lawyers. By 2011, it was 1.2 million lawyers. Japan has 17 times less per capita. 17 times less lawyers. And of course, some lawyers do good things, but in general, once you've got a country stuffed with accountants and lawyers, you know things are going wrong. Does anybody want to guess how many lawsuits Donald Trump has actually been involved in?
Thousands.
To the nearest thousand. 3,500, apparently. Can you imagine that, having been involved in 3,500 lawsuits before you even become president? Jeffrey Sachs wrote recently about corruption in the US, just how high corruption is, and how it's normal for the supporters of the very rich to write in support of tax havens because they defend their money from the predatory taxation of the US government, which of course taxes at a very low rate compared to the governments of other countries. If we become a tax haven, we become somewhere where the US rich can put their money and, in theory, save it from Donald. It's bizarre, because he's going to be spending it. You get the most ridiculous examples of things going wrong for the very rich. My favourite are always court cases. This is a court case of a man who's so legitimate, can't pronounce it, it's good, that most of the newspaper articles that I cite have now been removed from the newspaper websites. But the nice thing is, with the web, illegal news media copies news articles, and those copies stay up, so you can still find it. And of course, presumably the paper copies of the papers are still in the Bodleian. Last year's court case was between a hedge fund manager and his former wife, when she was claiming maintenance for their seven-year-old child, and part of her maintenance bill was needing £10,500 a year just to pay for wine, for when she has a drink of wine with another parent of another seven-year-old coming on a play date. Right, that's £50 a bottle of wine, and a huge amount of wine that's needed. The husband has homes in Cannes, Marrakesh, Miami, New York and London. His wife only has one home, so has to stay in hotels frequently, because that's what you have to do if you only have one home. You may not know this, but you know, obviously it gets boring after a few nights in your own home, and you need somewhere else. I now know why the super rich have lots of homes. The husband's just spent £20 million doing up his £18 million one of his houses in London, and they don't seem particularly happy. And he particularly doesn't want you to know about this aspect of his life. Donald Trump's son-in-law has talked about this and said that the media is made up of socially insecure smartasses who glory in the human failings of the rich and powerful. There's a tendency for people who make a lot of money to think that they made it because they're particularly skillful. They're not aware of how many other people tried to make it and fail, and the rate of failure is much higher in more unequal countries. The rate of business failure is enormously fast, which is partly why you need so many lawyers and accountants to tidy up the mess as business after business is started and fails. If anybody ever tells you it's great that there's a lot of startups in a place, it's not. Because the more startups you have, the more failures you're going to get. You want some degree of steadiness. Donald's son-in-law, a real estate investor, he secured his personal fortune in the end, but partly, of course, from the father who was doing it before. But he bought up 11,000 properties to rent in Rust Belt America and said that making a profit from them required a lot of evictions. And that's the son-in-law. There's an intimate connection. Let's go back out of 2016 to 2009. The Director General of the World Health Organization, Margaret Chan, in 2009, which is trying to identify the causes of the world fuel, food and financial crisis, said it was a single-minded pursuit of economic growth, globalisation, trade liberalisation, creating massive problems of inequality, volatility and precarity. Something, she said, in 2009 has gone horribly wrong. So the Director General of the WHO says it in 2009, the President of the United States is saying it in 2017. Liberals are complaining when he gives an inaugural address saying how terrible America is and starts saying it's great and we're in a mess. The Affordable Health Act, Obamacare. How much is it going to save the rich if and when he cancels Obamacare? For the richest, let's get the number right, the very richest households earning over $300 million a year, they would each save $7 million in taxes. Right. So imagine you're earning $300 million a year and your tax bill goes down by $7 million. Is it really going to improve your life? The bottom 90% of Americans are going to see no saving at all from this. My reason for optimism is nobody's winning out from doing the silly things. It is not like the 1980s in the UK, where the top quarter of British society saw their material situation actually improve, saw themselves go from 2.5 times average incomes to 3 times average incomes, saw themselves get a second car, have another foreign holiday or their first foreign holiday. When inequality rose in this country under Margaret Thatcher, a chunk of the population actually benefited materially. That has stopped happening anymore. My very last, this is a real reason for optimism, is the Prince Charles and the Prince's Trust. The Prince's Trust doesn't often produce very radical things or pieces of information, but since 2009, every year, the Prince's Trust has been surveying young people in Britain. And they did their last survey towards the end of 2016, and they published it in early 2017. This is for people aged 16 to 25 in the UK. And what they found was the worst results since they began surveying about young people's attitudes to the future and what's happening. They found that a quarter of all young people in the UK, 16 to 25, no longer felt in control of their lives. A third said they expected to have a worse standard of living than their parents. And my argument is they didn't think that, we should worry, because that is where we're heading. And it isn't necessarily a bad thing. You can have a lower material goods than your parents and have a better life. It depends on how you arrange it. More than a third did not feel in control of their job prospects. That's brilliant. At least more than a third now realise you can't control your job prospects at age 16 to 25. The worrying thing is the two-thirds of 16 to 25-year-old who somehow think that they've got a career plan mapped out that's going to work. A fifth said that they did not have the ability to change their circumstances. A sixth said that they thought their life would amount to nothing. That's very sad. But if things carry on getting worse, that is what's going to happen to at least a sixth of our population, would amount to nothing no matter how hard they tried. And fully 42% said that traditional goals like owning a house or a steady job were unrealistic. That these things have been getting rapidly worse in the last few years. I did a book in 2010 called Injustice, and in 2015 we produced a second edition. And when you produce a second edition, you're very lazy. All you do is you go through, you look at every fact and you Google the latest version of it and put it in so it looks up to date. What shocked me was just how much worse those facts, things that I said were stunning and terrible in 2010, including about the very rich, how much you could pay for the exclusive nursery fees for the most exclusive nurseries in New York. The statistics I said were shocking in 2010 were absolutely unshocking in 2015, because you have to pay so much more. It's a very, very rapid change. If you look at GDP since 2009, the crash in our wealth is absolutely enormous. And of course the pound has fallen, and we're about to feel the effects of the pound falling, because for 6 months you hedge against changes in currencies, and so there's lag to it. What to do? and how much longer have I got? If I'm going to be honest, I've only got 3 or 4 minutes with you before we do questions, so what to do? My cheap answer to this is that at 7:30 this evening I'm speaking in Queen's College to a load of students about what to do, and I haven't had enough time to tell you what to do. But you need to plan to do stuff. You need to say that you're not going to put up with this. It can't carry on. It isn't possible to put yourself in a bracket where you say, if I try really hard to be really selfish, I will be okay. When you look at Brazil and you look at the bottom of the top 1%, you can see that that doesn't work. When you look in this country, having a plan that says you will somehow become rich at the expense of others has become less and less sensible over time. Many things have in some ways got better. I've been highlighting the things that have recently got worse. I'm talking to students tonight about schools in Oxford. These are students who go to schools to help the kids with their homework. And you could say Oxford has much greater inequality in education now than it did when I was a child. The exam results are wider between the schools. The reputations of the schools are now firmer. People have an idea about which schools to avoid and which not to avoid. The fees in the private schools are much higher. The effort it takes to get into the most selective private schools is much harder, and so on. But at the same time, it's become more equal in Oxford. Back in the 1970s and 80s, majority of people would go in the Easter at age 15, partly because they could walk into a job in a car factory. If you went to one of the private schools in Oxford, you were about 10 times more likely to go to university than if you went to a state school when I went. Now, apart from one and a half state schools, a bit of effort, you can go to university. Might not help you very much, but you can go. And if you go to the most expensive school in Oxford, a bit of effort, you'll probably go to the same university as those kids from the state school go. Won't help you very much. And unlike the 1980s, where if you went to university you could guarantee a job and a career, possibly be able to pay a mortgage off for 25 years, you can't do that anymore. No matter where you're brought up in Oxford, it can be Summertown or Barton, right? You've no longer got that security. You really need a family wealth that will move towards you of about 2.5 million to be totally secure. And there are not that many families with that much wealth to share out amongst all the grandchildren. I think there's been an absolute tsunami of this kind of information. I think people are rapidly changing their evaluations of the future, particularly the middle class, are changing what they think is going to happen to them and their children. And I don't see attempts to make a selfish kind of grab by this group. I think the Conservative Party are working largely in the interest of about half of the 1%, which is the group that they largely are in. That's the Prime Minister, by dint of her husband, is in that group. But all of our last political leaders are in the 1% of all the parties, the major parties. I think this country is almost certainly going to be far poorer in the next 5 to 10 years. That would have happened anyway. It was George Osborne who said if you followed his economic plan, we will be the richest country by 2030. His plan included not leaving the EU. It was a silly plan anyway, and it wasn't going to happen, but we're certainly not following his plan as it is. It's going to be a poorer country. Already around the world, there are fewer goods moving by container ship than there were 4, 5, 6 years ago. Material consumption is dropping. We're going to have to adapt to being poorer. But there are ways of doing that where you actually can also improve your quality of life while having fewer holidays that you fly away to, while not having to have a second home or a third home, while not spending more on education than any other country in Europe because a third of our spending is done by 7% of parents. We have a very expensive education system in this country because we're so divided. There are lots of ways in which we can save money and come together. At the moment, no politician, apart from the Greens, can say you're not going to be better off in the future if you vote for me. But I think people are going to come to realise it soon. And when it begins to worry you, when it gets this bad, you begin to behave in different ways. Politically, the most obvious different way to behave, and it sounds very timid, but you simply vote for whichever candidate came second, the Conservatives and UKIP, at the last election in any constituency. The move towards tactical voting, anecdotally I've seen, as it's now just become common sense that that is what you do. We shouldn't believe that this particular former Conservative Party will be in power in 2020 or 2025. We should be aware of how much is likely to change in the next few years. I'll just leave you with one last one, so please think of a question for me. And it does require things getting worse, because if they don't, worse for some people in some ways, this isn't worse. Because if they don't, then things won't change. Housing prices have been falling at the top end of Manhattan in the last year. I like Forbes magazine, as you can probably tell. I'm an avid reader of it. Forbes magazine, about 5 months ago, claimed that Donald Trump had lost a quarter of his fortune due to the falling value of Manhattan top-end properties. In London, absolute collapse in properties over 10 million. Hardly any have been sold for over 10 million in the last 8 months. Prices are now falling in 5 boroughs of London. Not reported, because nobody who writes about house prices has an interest in telling you about them falling. According to Zoopla, in the last 3 months in Oxford, there were 211 sales of houses. Hasn't been that low for many, many, many years. You need prices to fall in London. They're the most expensive in the world. But as they fall, and when that fall spreads out, and as it's cushioned by a media telling you, oh, it'll go up next year, so that helps the fall slow down. As it spreads and spreads, our banks begin to fail their stress tests, because our banks' balance books are based on the mortgages they've lent, which is based on the value of that property. That then moves the angst and the precarity up from the 16 and 25 year olds to the 35 to 50 to 65 year olds, who think at least they can help their 16 to 25 year olds a bit by the wealth that they thought they had in their housing. I think if it hadn't happened like this and as quickly as this, we could adapt to it more easily and the chances of changing it would be less. I am generally optimistic. It's an optimism based on how bad things are. But if you want to convince me I'm wrong, you have to tell me in whose interest is it now not to change. Because that's what I find hard. I find it hard to identify a group where it actually makes sense for us to carry on as we are, and it's in their interest to do this. Thank you very much for your patience. Please ask me a question.
Do you have an explanation or a thought about why so many white women, particularly, voted for Donald Trump?
Yeah. Why did the white women vote for Trump? Over 92-95% of the pattern of votes was the same as it had been 4 years earlier. So it's a very similar, most people voted as they had voted in Barack's second election. That's the most important thing about the election. There's no landslide, there's no sudden change. It's a very small change. So most white women voted for Trump because most white women had always voted Republican. And most people are not that interested in politics. You're weird. You're sitting in Blackwell's at lunchtime listening to somebody talking about these things. Right? The vast majority of people in Oxford are, you wake up to politics 3 weeks before an election when you can't ignore it because they keep on That's the main one. Then the economists have done the best study I've seen of the election.
Sorry to interrupt. So that your idea of tactical voting people obviously don't apply that to their voting habits, do they?
Well, you can't vote very tactically in the US. There's only two parties.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that your vote makes a difference. Obviously, most people don't believe that. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Well, in the US, things have been getting worse much more slowly. So for 30 years, the bottom quarter have seen no increase in their real disposable income. It's a slow and steady and gradual change. Ours has been really dramatic since 2009-10. And before then, people in the bottom fifth, you know, were 16% better off than their parents. It's not much, but it was an actual improvement to living standards.
I was going to say, actually, in the States, because of the voting system, Hillary Clinton won the majority vote.
But
because of the system they have,
for Brexit,
that's why Donald Trump was. I don't think most women voted for Trump.
I think they did, 53% of white women, not most women, but white women did. People also voted for Trump because he offered change. Hillary was simply offering continuation of a norm that had got worse and worse. So the Economist study showed that the one factor that most moved about 10% of Americans in particular places was if they lived in an area that was going downhill faster than average, and they measured it by life expectancy. So it wasn't the poor that voted for Trump, it was white, better off people in areas going downhill faster. Trump offered change. It was the only offer of change on the books. Hillary was the same. Referendum exactly the same. It was nothing changes. I mean, Cameron didn't negotiate anything. There's nothing changes at all. You carry on having George and Dave. And it was an even better offer than Trump's, because it was an undefined, you know, it'll just be better, and it won't even involve building a wall and making Europeans pay for it. You know, so it's easier to sell.
The NHS will get £350 million.
Oh yeah, £350 million for the NHS, and our life expectancy is falling at this point. People's health was getting worse. People in the US and UK have only been offered exactly the same, all change, and they've gone for change.
I presume that one of the drivers for the high level of inequality we have is from the multinationals. Yeah. And I was wondering how you saw the power of the multinationals being checked, because I'm presuming, correct me if I'm wrong, that you would need to do something about that. And as things stand, they have the ability to shift their money from one place to another. Yeah. And for the people who run the multinationals, I'm not sure that the argument that seems sensible to you and me about the living standards of people in general, I'm not sure they impinge on them, because for them, a bit like Donald Trump, it's just like a game. Yeah. It's how much you can make. So it seems to me that that's an important driver of the problem that you've got, and I'm not sure you've quite covered that.
Yeah. We treat multinationals different to other countries. So, if you look at the best off 1% in Switzerland, and Switzerland has a lot of multinationals, including ones headquartered there, they have an income which is half the income of our 1%. They're paid less by the same firms. And the reason they're paid less in Switzerland, and this is the case for almost all the rest of Europe, is that the taxes are much higher. So it wouldn't make sense to pay them more. So you pay a banker in Zurich less than a banker in London. The banker in Zurich tends to be cleverer. Zurich didn't make as many messes as we made. But you pay them less because otherwise you lose the money in taxes. But also the top end of property is cheaper. They can actually afford to live there. So multinationals, by definition, are multinational. They can be everywhere. But in France and Germany and the Netherlands, and particularly in Scandinavia, they pay their top people less and they fit in better. And they also pay people at the bottom more because they're forced to, because the society as a whole pays them more, otherwise they couldn't get a cleaner. So a cleaner in Basel costs three times a cleaner in Oxford, and a multinational has to pay the cleaner more to get the cleaner. So it's that's part of our problem. Other countries have control. The country which controls multinationals the most, but can partly through language, but I don't think that's the reason, is Japan. So Japan has fewer people, I think, paid over €1 million a year than the people working in one tower in Canary Wharf. That's an incredible control of extreme inequality. There's still inequalities in Japan, there's still multinationals. But there's just an ethos that these extreme differences are wrong and not required.
Which party do you think is most likely to bring about the kind of changes that you'd like to see?
I think it'll be a coalition of parties is much more likely to bring out changes than any one party. Because a coalition is just more likely anyway. That's where we're heading. We're becoming more European. The real irony of all of this is, you know, we're now looking after our children in a European way. They're not leaving home anymore. We might as well be Italian. We're heading towards 8 or 9 significant political parties, as what a normal European country does. Our banking sector is about to get smaller, become like a normal European country. A coalition, I think, is more likely to, a coalition in a time of national emergency, financial emergency. Partly because the coalition can always blame each other for it, or say we had to do it because that was the agreement. I can't see any reason to think in Scotland that the Scottish National Party will diminish. I think they will be there. I think the Liberals will be back. There are obvious reasons why the Liberals can increase their number of MPs. Greens are growing in popularity. They need a deal so that there are at least 4 or 5 seats that the Greens can concentrate their votes on where Labour doesn't try. But that'll only get you 4 or 5 MPs. But it has a huge tactical effect politically. Of, you know, if all the Greens of Oxfordshire could head off to Bristol West next time, you know, it would be very, very effective. But a coalition of who's ever there, and possibly even a Conservative Party with its fingers burnt. You know, things go terribly, terribly wrong, and the party knows how to survive. Can you remember how many leaders they had between 1997 and 2010? I've almost forgotten who wasn't a Conservative Party leader over that, which minister hasn't once been in charge. Time of national emergency, that's where we're heading towards. And then you do things like Ireland was forced to do. Ireland had to bring in a land value tax. I'm not looking forward or celebrating this, I just see an inevitability. You have a better outcome if you see this coming and say we have to change a lot of things.
Are you worried at all about what we've seen in terms of right-wing funded think tanks and groups in effect hijacking the social media and exploiting its abilities? Yeah. And we've seen that with climate change, Katrina, and around 2008 when they changed the consensus dramatically in the States.
Yeah.
And they seem to be replicating it through the various heritage organizations.
Yeah. Now, I'm more worried than I was about right-wing think tanks. There are a tiny number of people. I think in the UK I know about half of them. So it's amazing how few people you actually need. The example that just hasn't been investigated is that the Leave campaign was run by the former chief executive of the Taxpayers Alliance. The Taxpayers Alliance got what it wanted. It got us to leave Europe. Nobody's properly investigated the Taxpayers Alliance, where its funding came from. But Matthew Elliott, who was its CEO, was the CEO of the Leave campaign. His sidekick was Dominic Cummings, who was Michael Gove's spad. Yeah, it's a small number. These young men, they're younger than me, I can now call them young men. But a tiny group of less than half a dozen far-right young men with a disproportionate influence, but huge amounts of funding in a little copy of what happens in the US. And they're really upset at the moment because everybody's saying inequality is bad. Even Davos have said it's bad. If Davos normally talks about many things being problematic, this time it just said one thing's bad. And they're very angry. You can look them up and you see they're writing blogs this week about how nobody understands that inequality is wonderful because it rewards top talents and makes you efficient. And eventually you own lots of casinos and Trump Towers, you know. You back first, then you go.
I'm a US-UK dual citizen. I've watched two countries this year. I feel I've watched them both. And I would love to believe that we will change in this direction, that things will get so bad we change it. But I trained as a historian. There are a lot of historical examples of things getting very bad, and then they turn to the right. They turn a different way. Yeah. What gives you faith
that
it won't do that?
Well, that we won't become violent and fascist. Optimism and hope. So the rise of the far right not looking as dramatic. When you step back and look at it, New York Times did a wonderful set of graphs of the rise over 15 years. It's not as fast as we think. I've drawn graphs now where, well, using this better word, you can define Republican voting now as far right if you believe that Republicans actually listen to what Donald was saying. It's and you can kind of see there in the pattern that we've had. And then that is a very bad news story if in effect we now have a far right party in charge of the US. The way I get my optimism is by looking at the support of young people for war and violence over the last 100 years. And you can chart an incredible rise at one extreme in terms of pacifism, but slightly less extreme than pacifism, simply questioning, not being willing to fight for queen or king and country. We know that levels of violence have dropped and dropped and dropped. We are much less violent than our parents or grandparents. We have the most violent playgrounds in Europe. Our playgrounds for children are much less violent than they were. The drop in violence, by the way, beautifully correlates with feminism in the 1970s. So feminist mums produce softer boys, is the suggestion. Half of all young women in Britain going to university. You know, it's not like 1930s Germany. And a faith in human ability. That's, you know, how stupid would we have to be to start expanding our army and talking about doing this? You're looking at two countries that are declining rapidly economically. They're on the way down. It's always painful on the way down. It was painful for the Dutch when they were on the way down. It's just a long time ago. Historically, there are very few examples, by definition, of hegemonic, all-powerful countries going on the way down. And you can look at them. I don't think I, you know. And I do look at the Dutch and go, the Dutch was the most powerful country, United Provinces before the UK. Wonderful place now, tallest Europeans on the world, second happiest country, very equal. You know, if you want a really optimistic future, eventually you learn from being the world's bully, you learn to become a normal child in the playground. But that's my optimism is based on these things. And our ability, our ability not to be duped. And the worrying thing is that we're not that clever. That's what's frightening. None of us, particularly people who work in universities, who don't know they're not that clever.
I very much agreed with your point about how the current system is bust and it isn't working, not even for the interests of the wealthy. And sometimes you see statements by Mervyn King, the old governor of the Bank of England, who said, well, actually, this doesn't make sense. This can't carry on. This doesn't work. And there are whole sections of, you know, people who are very well connected, very wealthy, who are recognised. You know, there's a discussion in Japan, isn't there, about helicopter money. Yeah. To actually give money to poor people to stimulate a capitalist economy. They're so debt, you know, that's a debt dreadful thing to have to contemplate such an option as that. So there's a really big debate. But then you see in this country, you see, say, the arrival of Jeremy Corbyn. And Jeremy Corbyn is only old Labour. That's all he is. You would think he's an ultra-left communist nutter, the way that the press describe him. absolute hysteria that Jeremy Corbyn is treated with. Doesn't get a fair hearing, you know, whether you agree with him or not, he doesn't get a fair hearing. So I think that you're right in terms of what you're saying about the logic of the situation, but I don't think that the politics have developed in line with the economic underlying economic situation. And I really disagree with you about Ireland. I think the coalition government in Ireland was horrific, absolutely horrific. They got family there, and they say, you know, this was awful. You know, it implemented the austerity from Europe. It was an awful government. So I think there's a big question about why there is such a huge lag in the in politics behind what is increasingly, you know, people reckoning the economic reality.
Okay. Yeah, I agree about Ireland. I mean, Ireland's had a rising suicide rate that we haven't seen. So I'm not saying what the government did was good. I'm saying they had to do things in those circumstances. And the land value, the other thing to say about the land value tax, I think, is a fairer thing. It's even slightly progressive. If your property was worth more than €1 million, which is an expensive property in Ireland, it went up to 1% of the value. So, but that, I'm cherry picking the most progressive thing that they did. In that case, speed of change. If you take Jeremy Corbyn winning two leadership elections, this is the fastest change to a Labour Party since Ramsay MacDonald in the 1930s. It's the speed of a nature of a change of a party. All our political parties had moved far, far to the right gradually as we became more unequal. So the Conservatives moved so far to the right, they could no longer be a member of the European Conservative Group, and they had to join some weird people from Poland, which they're still in the group with. His election and that party is switching back to being a normal, boring, left-wing mass European party. My optimism is that he's taking all the flak for it. So that when he goes, and he will go at some point because he never wanted to be there and he's elderly, whoever takes over from him in that party, which will probably be a young MP, although my age cohort are slightly older than me, still some of them dream of it, but they've almost been bypassed now. Whichever young Labour MP becomes leader will look incredibly competent and managerial, and able to do things, and they won't be described necessarily as far left, because they'll only be enacting the policies of the party that was moved by its members and by its former leader. That'd be my prediction for the Labour Party. Whoever follows Jeremy, because the press's story, if their story is he's the most incompetent man ever, whoever becomes the next leader, and there will be one, will be presented as being more competent. The Liberals have moved to the left under Tim Farron. Even the Conservatives have actually moved. They've ditched loads of George Osborne's policies. His main policies for spending money was bolstering the housing market to try to make house prices go as high as possible. So he had a thing called Help to Buy. We've still got Help to Buy on new build properties, but the big Help to Buy, which would lend you up to 40% of the value of a flat in London, it was ended on the 31st of last month, quietly. That's an incredible change for a Tory party. In their hearts, they haven't become left-wing. It's the pragmatic. You do not underwrite 40% of a flat or house purchase in London while house prices are falling down. So the government have pulled out of the housing market. They've also said that they won't do any additional cuts to welfare over that that's been done. Okay, not very nice, but compared to the trajectory we've been on for the last few years, is different. And maybe pragmatic. One more? Yep.
Yeah, I agree with the last speaker quite a lot of what he said. And I think a lot of economists today and policymakers and government are actually realising that we need revolutionary types of economic models, actually, instead of the so-called rational man economics.
Yeah.
That's why it collapsed. That this idea that people will actually act rationally and in their own best interests. is complete bollocks, actually, and they're bringing in something called behavioural economics and looking at how psychology, how we actually function as human beings and we make our decisions economically.
Yeah.
And that underpins, and that's a radical philosophical
change. I agree, it's a big change. Andy Haldane, I think his post keeps changing, he's something like deputy head of something at the Bank of England. Andy Haldane's speeches have lots of this in. If you've got a set of people who for over a generation had one way of thinking about the world, and that way of thinking of the world gets badly damaged in 2008-09, and then nothing shows that it was correct in the years that follow it, the people don't change their views overnight. You know, it's like believing in a particular part of Christianity. You know, if something turns up that suggests that your particular sect actually was a bit dodgy and isn't worth being in as another one's nicer, you don't suddenly reject what you believed, but you find it harder to get new converts and other things change. And part of our pessimism is not understanding that you don't get change that fast, not within a month, not within a year. The very slow way in which you get change is for education. So if you look at what children are being taught, even though we have a national curriculum, you know, you try and be racist in a British school and see how long the teacher will tolerate it in a classroom. It's completely different from when I was at school. That kind of thing has long effect. That's certainly happening over the financial crisis. You know, the writings in universities, students are taught this is a terrible mess because somebody thought our banks would work and clearly they wouldn't. And that's being taught to students, but that'll have a longer time lag. For people in power, it's not that quick, but it certainly feels it's happening. It gets me back, because I should start, I'll bring it to a close again. That thing I said at the start about it certainly feels like time is passing, but that's just what you feel because you're a particular kind of a space-time pattern. It's really easy to think that nothing much is happening because we adapt so very quickly to change week by week by week. If I had sat here 4 months ago and said that in this week Donald Trump would be in power and this would be his executive orders and this is what he would have done, you'd have just said that's complete madness or this is terrible, well, how on earth can that happen? You've got used to it since you saw it on the news last night. And whatever you see on the news tonight, whatever else executive order he's passed today, you'll be shocked when you watch it at 10 o'clock in my case tonight. And by the next morning, that's history, you're used to it. And part of my optimism is we haven't noticed how fast things have changed and how many attitudes have improved. Because we don't do the kind of boring thing I do in my day job, which is update something we did 3 or 5 years ago and see the extent of change. Yeah. So look at what Ed Miliband was saying in Labour 5 years ago. Look at what Gordon Brown was saying 5 years before him about an end to boom and bust because of the wonderful City of London. That was Gordon Brown. Look at what Tony Blair was saying 5 years before him. You go Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, Ed Miliband, Jeremy Corbyn. Incredible speed of change. Look at young people's optimism for their careers. And it is, I will do well. My university degree will sort me out. I will get a master's and so on. Through to, this really doesn't look very, very good. And they're going to stop me being able to go over to Europe to work as well by taking away my citizenship. And they made me vote in the referendum, and then the old people won it.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. It's an incredibly, incredibly quick change. I think you need some optimism, because if you don't tell people things can get better, then there really isn't much chance of things getting better. Or they'll believe the people who tell them, things will get better if you follow me, I'm a strong leader, do what I say, build a wall, and get rid of those brown people. You need an optimism which isn't that kind of optimism. That's how you stop fascism. What's hard about that optimism is it requires accepting that things have got really bad, but then accepting they can get better. But this has happened before again and again, historically. So if you looked in the 1920s and 30s at children then, you would have never said that children growing up in the 1920s or 30s would become the golden generation who would have the best improvement in life chances that we'd ever seen in a country. If you looked at Finland or Sweden in the 1920s, you'd never say that these incredibly unequal countries will become the most equal countries in the world. If you look at Japan after the war, you wouldn't say it will become industrially world leading within 30 years. Just as things get bad, they also do get better, and they get better in very unpredictable ways. That's 1 hour. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you. They paid me in a sandwich.
Thank you so much for an absolutely fascinating talk. I mean, as you're saying, although as a country and as a world we're changing, it's great to hear that there is some optimism for a future that could be good. Although, yes, it's very scary also to hear all the facts and figures. But thank you so much for a great talk, and thank you for coming. Books by Danny are available to browse on this table here. A lot of them are in the 3 for 2 as well, so if you want to do the 3 for 2 offer, and I'm sure that Danny would be more than happy to sign and dedicate any books if you would like to. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.